This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone. I'm Talia.
And I'm Tanya.
And together we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast. Hey, Tanya.
Hi, Talia.
Everything going well?
So far, so good.
Well, I have a pisser.
Oh, perfect.
And I'm dedicating it to all of our Aussie fans.
Oh, it's an Australian case.
Yes, it is a story I read last year, and I always wanted to write up, but seemed to somehow get distracted. But I did it, and I'm going to tell it. Are you ready?
Always.
If you're from Australia and you're a true crime fan, you know all about Wanda Beach. It was a Saturday, January 9th, in 1965. And 16-year-old Marianne Schmidt and her 15-year-old best friend, Christine Schrock, they planned a trip to Cronulla. That's an affluent beachside suburb known for its stretch of beautiful beaches in Sydney, Australia.
Oh, it sounds lovely. I wish I was there right now.
So for those of us who don't live in Australia, January is summer break for kids, the opposite of what we're used to in the United States. On January 9th, both girls had visited Marianne's mother, Elizabeth. Now, Elizabeth was in King George V's hospital, recovering from what I deem to believe a pretty serious operation because she had quite a long recovery. The two teens went and they visited Elizabeth and they asked if they could go to the beach the next day. Marianne even offered to take her four younger siblings with them. And this was a two-hour train ride to Cronulla Beach. Elizabeth told the teens that they could go. After all, it wasn't the first time that they had gone to this beach without the supervision of an adult. Both Marion and Christine were really responsible, dependable girls, and they were described as kind of shy. They usually kept to themselves, and I know they never caused any problems for their families. Marianne and Christine had been to Wanda Beach, which is just one of Cronulla's handful of beaches, only 9 days earlier on New Year's Day. On that day, the two of them went to the beach, and they ended up meeting two boys named Ted and Jim. Neither Christine nor Marianne had ever had any boyfriends, and as I said, they were somewhat shy teens, but they were at that age where they were really interested in boys. So spending the day listening to music with two cute boys they met on the beach had to have been really exciting for them.
A teenage girl's dream.
Right?
Right? At the beach with some cute boys?
Hell yeah, man.
Doesn't get any better.
Nope. Later, Marion would write in her diary about how the girls went so far as to kiss the boys. Marianne went back to the beach a few days later with her siblings, and this time Christine didn't join them. While at South Cronulla Beach, Marianne left her siblings for a bit, telling them she was going to go walk the shoreline north to Wanda Beach. She never told them why, and it could be as simple as she just wanted to go for a walk, but we'll never really know. The two teen girls, they were described as inseparable. Marianne Schmidt had moved to Brush Road, and that's in West Ryde, which is a suburb of Sydney, about a year earlier with her family. The Schmidts were German immigrants who moved to Australia to better themselves. But tragedy struck the Schmidts not long after moving. Father Helmut, he died of Hodgkin's disease, leaving Mother Elizabeth to raise their seven children alone. Marianne wasn't the oldest Schmidt child. She had two older brothers, Hans and Helmut Jr.
I love these names.
Who helped support and care for their younger children. Marianne shared a room with her 9-year-old sister, Trixie.
Again, a cute name.
And Trixie just adored her big sister. Marianne also had three younger brothers, Peter, Wolfgang, and Norbit.
I tell you, these names are awesome.
All seven Schmidt children were really well-adjusted and really well-mannered kids who looked after each other. Now, Christine Schrock lived next door to the Schmidts. She lived with her grandparents, the Tighes. Her father had died a few years earlier, and her mother, Beryl, remarried. For whatever reason, Christine didn't live with her mother. She chose to live with her grandparents, and they were her primary caregivers. Both girls were really excited to head out to Cronulla Beach. They were going to go on Sunday, January 10th, because they only had a few more weeks before school started, and they really wanted to make the most of it. And as you were saying, going to the beach.
Oh, man.
Boys, hell yeah.
Hell yeah, sign me up.
But when they woke up on Sunday morning, the forecast wasn't in their favor. It was cool and rainy and not the kind of weather you want when you're going to go to the beach, especially when it's going to take you 2 hours to get there.
Yeah.
So they decided to try again the next day, Monday, January 11th. The conditions on Monday morning were better than the day before, but again, not really ideal beach weather. Although it was about 30 degrees Celsius, 86 Fahrenheit, it was very windy, and there was a chance of rain. But unlike the day before, this time Marianne and Christine decided they weren't going to let the crappy weather deter them from going. In 1965, the Cronulla Beach area was the only beach the girls could access via train. That was the only way they could get to any beach. Now that morning, Christine spoke with her grandmother about her plans for the day. And she mentioned that she and Marianne planned on taking Marianne's four younger siblings to what was known as the Green Hills Sand Dunes. Grandma said, I don't think it's that good of an idea to be dragging little kids through the sand dunes. But Christine said, I'm going to do it anyway. In a nice way. Because she was a nice girl.
No, it'll be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably what she said.
It'll be fun.
It'll be fun. They'll love it.
It was about 8:30 a.m. when the six children set out for their beach journey. They grabbed their towels and the lunch Marianne had packed the night before. And they started walking to the train station. Marianne yelled out to her brother Hans, see you later, and shut the door. That would be the last words he'd ever heard spoken from his younger sister. I mapped out the route to the train station from Brush Road. I have no idea where the girls lived. I just know they lived on it. And I get a little OCD about things. It appeared to be about 2 miles away.
Oh, damn.
But I'm not an expert by any means in Australia or mapping. The six of them caught the train and they headed south to Cronulla. While on the train, Marianne and Christine made casual conversation with a teen boy. He appeared to be about maybe 16, who was also on the train. I'm not sure exactly where he was headed. That's all we know. The six children arrived to Cronulla at around 11 a.m. And by that time, the weather was squally, making it too dangerous to swim or surf. And the water was closed for swimming, which had to be a huge...
Oh, bummer.
Bummer. Although the children were disappointed, they decided to not turn back around and they decided to just hang out at the beach, explore it. They started at the southern end of Cronulla Beach. And at some point while they were there, 7-year-old Wolfgang saw both Marianne and Christine talking to a boy who looked to be roughly 16. He was hunting for crabs with what appeared to be a homemade spear. The wind gusts caused the sand to whip at the children's legs, so they climbed up on some rocks to get shelter. But Wolfgang really wanted to swim, and he started bugging Marianne about maybe taking him to a more shallow area, take a quick swim, and she acquiesced. Eventually, the two returned to the group at the rocks, and they decided to just have a picnic there. Marianne got out the fruit and the sandwiches that she'd packed the night before, and she handed them out to her younger siblings. But Christine didn't pack a lunch. She had instead brought some money to buy something to eat at one of the small beach shops. While the other kids ate, Christine left, and she returned a few minutes later. Where exactly she went, nobody knows. Now, my guess is that she walked to a little local food stand and she bought what is called a Chico roll. And it's kind of like a Chinese spring roll. It's a big thing in Australia.
Sounds delicious.
I know. When they were done eating, Marianne and Christine told the younger children that they wanted to take them to the Green Hills Sand Dunes, which is about 2 kilometers or 1.2 miles north. And if you really think about it, that's kind of a bit of a hike on a beach in windy weather with the sand blowing. I mean, these were gusts of wind. Locals knew the sand dunes were not an ideal place for children. But I don't think that Marianne and Christine did. The sand dunes in 1965 were a secluded, remote area, quite a distance from where most beachgoers went. It was filthy, littered with trash, and not just the garbage kind of trash, but human trash.
Oh, no.
Nude sunbathers like to go there because of its remoteness. And then, of course, pervs that like to watch nude sunbathers.
Of course.
Liked to go there, too. And back in 1965, homosexuality was a crime in Australia, and it was also considered a mental disorder. So the dunes were a place where homosexual men could go and have casual, kind of George Michael-type sexual encounters. That's what I'm envisioning after how it was described.
This is not a place for children.
Right? And then there was horny heterosexuals that would go there and just have sex.
Well, sure.
And although I didn't read anything that said this, I'm also assuming that people doing drugs and probably drinking would be hanging out at those dunes too. The group of kids left their stuff on the rocks and they began that 1.2 mile journey. They passed what's called the Wanda Surf Club, which I'm assuming had some restaurants, probably some bathrooms, etc. After trekking along the beach for another 400 meters or 430 yards, the younger children began complaining. The sand was whipping their legs. It was getting in their eyes. I mean, they were not having a real good time.
They came to the beach to go in the water.
Right, not go for a hike. I've walked with you on the beach before. It can take the wind out of you after a while. The group decided to seek shelter in a depression, a dip between 2 sand dunes. That was about 100 feet from the beach, maybe a little more. Now, so those not from Australia understand, the beach goes on for a few miles. And once you pass Wanda Beach, the dunes get really large, really deep. It's a lot of area. So you're walking, you have the ocean to your right, you got the sand on your toes. To the left are some sandy dunes, and then beyond the sandy dunes are the thicker part of the dunes where there's this bushy hillside. Marianne and Christine told the kids once they were in that little depression area that they were going to head back south to the rocks and get all their beach stuff that they had left behind, and that they would be back in roughly 20 minutes. Christine turned on the transistor radio she brought with them, so the kids had something to entertain them while they were gone. 10-year-old Peter noticed the girls weren't walking south towards where they left their stuff on the rocks, but were instead walking north. And he yelled to them, "Hey, you're headed in the wrong direction." But they just laughed. And then he yelled out, "Where are you going?" And one of them replied, quote, "We are going mad." And they giggled as they just kept walking further away. After just a few minutes, Peter asked Wolfgang, and keep in mind he's 7, to walk and see if he could find the girls. He did. He spotted them in a distance, but even more surprising to him, besides the fact they're in the wrong direction, was that they were talking to a tall, slender teen boy with shaggy long hair who was walking between the 2 girls with his arms around both of them. One thing that stood out about the boy is he had white zinc oxide on his nose. He had a blue beach towel draped over his shoulders, and he was shirtless with some gray shorts. He looked like a surfer kid to Wolfgang, or what in Australia I heard being called surfy kids. Wolfgang watched as the 3 teens sauntered from the beach up into the sand dunes and then disappeared from his sight. About 10 minutes later, Wolfgang saw the teen boy emerge from the sand dunes without his sister and Christine. He yelled out to him, "Hey, where are the girls?" And the teen just kept walking further and further down away from him, having never responded. Now, whether he was ignoring Wolfgang or the gust of winds drowned out his voice, we'll never know. The sun started to set around 5 p.m., and those kids, those four young kids, were still in that depression between the two dunes, waiting for the teen girls to come back. Finally, the oldest, Peter, he's 10, decided that Wolfgang, Trixie, and 6-year-old Norbert needed to go home. I mean, it's just surprising to me, the oldest in this group
is 10.
And Peter knew the last train to West Ride left the station at 6, and he didn't want to miss it. Marianne and Christine had been gone for almost 4 hours.
Oh my goodness.
Following Peter, the children made their way south down the beach, where they found their beach stuff on the rocks, still undisturbed. They managed to catch the train, and they ended up at West Ride at about 8 p.m. And then from there, they walked to Brush Road. Concerned, Peter told his brother Hans about Christine and Marianne leaving and never coming back. Hans went next door and he spoke with Christine's grandma, Mrs. Teig. And she immediately called the police. Two officers from the Ride Police Department showed up at Christine's grandparents' house at about 11:40 p.m. After being convinced by Christine's grandma that this was not normal, they ended up issuing a missing persons report, and they broadcast it to all the Sydney police stations with descriptions of the two missing girls. It was done through telex. Ever heard of telex?
Yes.
Oh, shit, I wasn't expecting that.
I think so.
It's just a precursor to a fax machine, basically. Christine was described as having a fair complexion with light shoulder-length hair. She was last seen wearing a green and white blouse and white shorts. And she was described as petite, slender, and small. Grandma told police that she knew Christine also had a sanitary belt on, which is what they used to use to put a maxi pad in place, right?
Right.
Old school stuff. Because she was obviously on her period. Unlike Christine, Marianne had a dark complexion. She had dark hair. She was a little bit bigger than Christine, but again, still pretty small statured. And she was last seen wearing a one-piece black swimsuit that had lace on the front, and she had a colored sleeveless blouse over that. In the beginning, the police didn't really do that much to find the girls. Like, I don't even think they went to the beach. I mean, it was dark, but I'm just saying, I don't even think they went to the beach. It's 1965. When two teen girls don't rush home from a fun day at the beach, they, you know, really didn't think it was completely something to raise all the alarm bells. However, Christine and Marianne didn't fit the typical wild child profile. So, again, it was definitely out of character. The next day, at about 2:30 p.m., 17-year-old Peter Smith, he had taken his three young nephews on a walk along the beach near Wanda Beach, and then they went to the Green Hills sand dunes. The beach was still closed that day due to high winds, and the weather had cooled to roughly 68 degrees Fahrenheit, 20 degrees Celsius. Since they couldn't swim, they searched the dunes for flotsam and jetsam. You know what that is?
Those are the eels from The Little Mermaid.
Is that the names of them? Okay. Well.
Are they plants?
No.
Huh.
We could keep going.
Shells?
Nope.
I'm all out of options.
Flotsam is unwanted materials or goods that have been thrown overboard from a ship. And jetsam is the wreckage of a ship or its cargo.
Oh.
They're just stuff discarded into the sea somehow. So that's what they were looking for, seeing if they could find anything cool.
Like buried treasure.
Yes. Smith and his nephews were 200 meters or 650 feet inland when something unusual caught Smith's eye in a depression between two dunes. The area Peter Smith was at, that was about a quarter mile north of where the Schmidt children had been waiting for Christine and Marianne that day. I could be completely wrong about the distance, I got a little confused after a while, but I think it could be most likely right. Anyway, as he got closer, he saw what looked like
a mannequin?
Yes.
Oh, damn.
It's never a goddamn mannequin. He saw this foot sticking out of the sand and believed a mannequin had been buried there. He went to touch the object and noticed just a few feet away, there was a face of a female with thick, dark hair kind of peeking out of the sand a little bit.
Okay, that's freaky, right?
Super, super freaky.
Scare the shit out of me.
And there's a picture that our patrons can see on the Patreon post. And also for our Apple subscribers, you guys can go to the webpage and you can see the picture of the foot and of her face.
Oh, no.
It's not up close.
Okay.
Peter Smith and his nephews hightailed it all the way back to Wanda Surf Club, which is about a half a mile away. He asked to use the phone and he called the police and he reported to them that he thought he found a dead girl buried in the dunes. The police met him at the beach club and from there he took him to the location of the body. As the police were looking at the scene, they noticed there were two more feet sticking out of the sand.
Ah, shit.
And they knew they had a double homicide on their hands. It didn't take them long to put two and two together with the missing girls. Now, the two bodies weren't really buried in the sand. It was more like sand was tossed over them as an afterthought. And the gusting winds had begun to unearth the shallow sand that served as their grave. Detectives dug the girls' bodies out with their bare hands. While they were digging, one officer yelled out, quote, "Oh my God, look at that. Her head's almost been cut off." Marianne's throat had been slashed so deeply that she was, for all intents and purposes, decapitated.
Oh my God.
I think there was just some skin left. The foot, Peter Smith discovered that afternoon, was Marianne's. That's her foot and her face. She was laying on her right side. She was nude from the waist down. Her right leg was bent at the knee, almost touching her right arm in a right degree angle. Okay.
Oh.
Now, this is where I can't figure out if she was in the fetal position or if she was in a right position. The left leg was also bent at the knee, too, and formed a right angle.
Is she laying on her back?
But they said she was laying on her side.
She must have been in the fetal position. That's what it sounds like, right?
Yeah, but then why wouldn't you just say the other leg was on top of it?
Right.
And they never do. I don't know. If anybody knows the answer to whether it was a right position or a fetal position, let us know. But I feel like if it was a fetal position, I would have read it somewhere. Either way, Christine's body was found face down and her head was next to Marianne's left foot. Now, this is how Christine's body was described at the scene. Both legs were slightly parted and her pair of white cotton briefs were placed on top of her buttocks. Between her legs were a pair of white shorts, which had been tightly packed into her crotch.
Ouch!
I don't know if that means inside or just, I don't know.
Like jammed in there?
Yeah, I don't know. The sanitary belt and pad were on the right side of her buttocks. Her right arm was at a right angle to the body with the elbow bent, and the forearm was near the side of her face. I don't know what her left arm was doing. Didn't say. She was also wearing a heart-shaped locket around her neck. Gold earrings and a gold signet ring was on her right ring finger. Plus, she had a gold bracelet on her right wrist. Doesn't seem like robbery would obviously be. And, I mean, wasn't
not with all that gold jewelry left behind.
So the autopsies for the girls. Christine's skull was fractured by some sort of blunt object that the medical examiner said was most likely either a rock, a log, a large log, or a metal pipe. She had 7 stab wounds. She was stabbed in her right shoulder blade, behind her right ear. She had 3 on the side of her back, near her waistline, 1 on the right side of the base of her neck, and 1 time in the neck. She had 2 small prick marks on her back below the other wounds on her back, and a small nick below her backside neck wounds. Now, on the front side, she had 6 parallel cuts to her neck, two black eyes, and her chin had an abrasion on it. She'd clearly been beaten and stabbed. Both of her lungs and her liver were punctured, and her calves had scratch marks on them. The medical examiner said that Christine was stabbed with a knife roughly a half inch wide and at least 2.5 inches long. There were recent abrasions to her genitals, suggesting an attempted intercourse, but her hymen was still intact, and there was no sperm found in or around her. Mary Ann's autopsy was no better. It was conducted by the same medical examiner. His name was Dr. Lang, and she also sustained a brutal attack. Her left arm had 2 stab wounds on the outside of it and 2 on the inside, which have to be made like defensive wounds, right? It has to be. She'd been stabbed in the left breast, and that wound traveled down through her lung, penetrating her heart. She'd also been stabbed 4 times on the right side of her back, 3 times in the middle of her back, and 1 in her left shoulder blade, plus another 1 somewhere on the left side. She sustained a large and deep laceration to her throat that, as I said, almost decapitated her. She also had a 2-inch scratch near her crotch on her upper thighs. Mary Ann had been raped prior to her death, and sperm was found inside her. I read so many different reports and 2 books, okay? And none of them had the exact same thing. But this is the best I could do to be accurate. So the sperm was analyzed, and in 1965, the best they could do was indicate the blood type. And the best they could do with this was indicate that it was from someone with either A.
Stop it.
Or B. Or AB.
Or O.
Or O.
No, really?
That's what it said.
Stop it.
That is exactly what it said. I'm like, what am I missing here? A couple of positives and negatives? I don't know what I'm missing.
Not much.
Obviously, that did narrow shit down. Dr. Lang stated that there was only 1 murder weapon used on both girls, and it was a knife like I described. It's been described as a fishing knife, it's been described as a stiletto, and it's also been described as a spear, and all the different things that I've read. So I'm not really sure which one, but you get the point. It's slender, it's long, and it's deadly. So what the hell happened in those dunes?
That's what I'd like to know.
Police set up lights, and they worked through the nighttime, because this was a big scene. They discovered a 34-meter, 112-foot-long bloody drag mark in the sand.
Wow.
It started from the top of a dune, and it went down an incline, and it ended in a gully between 2 dunes. But what's really interesting about this is that you have this very long drag mark. It's a trail of blood, too. Every 10 feet or so, there's small pools of blood buried just slightly under the windblown sand. Now, with the length being over 100 feet, or 34 meters, that meant that there were over 10 tiny pools of blood. Now, in these particular areas, investigators determined that one of the girls, and I'll just tell you right now, Christine, was bleeding while placed there long enough to create a small pool of blood. So what's the significance of that? That means whomever was dragging the body had to stop briefly to rest at least 10 times.
And she's little.
Yes. Thank you. That's the next thing I was going to say. Given the adrenaline that had to be rushing through this guy's body, the fact that he's moving someone downhill, and the fact that Christine is petite, you wouldn't expect a killer to need to take 10 repeated breaks. Was he physically unfit, small, or weak?
Or all of the above.
Or all of the above. Before I tell you more, I'm going to take a quick break. The medical examiner, Dr. Lane, further reported that the girls died around the same time or within a half hour of each other. As for the time of death, all Dr. Lang could say is that it was between 2 p.m. and midnight on that morning.
That's helpful.
Well, the warmth of the sand that covered the girls made it hard for him to pinpoint the time of death. Both girls died from blood loss, with Christine dying from just the repeated stab wounds and Marianne dying from her neck. In Christine's stomach, Dr. Lang found undigested celery and cabbage, which he concluded meant she had died within an hour of eating. And her blood alcohol was found to be 0.015. So police began to speculate that maybe she had consumed some alcohol and eaten with her killer prior to death. Her grandma and her mom, they both said, Christine got sick off the smell of alcohol. She was disgusted by it. And there's no way that 15-year-old would willingly have drank it, any alcohol. However, as we both know, I'm just thinking of myself when I was 15. I might have been like, oh, that stuff's nasty.
It's gross.
And then totally sneak it. Now, in 1965, the medical community, they weren't aware that alcohol levels may develop during decomposition. And levels up to 0.20 do not necessarily indicate that anyone's consumed any alcohol prior to death.
That's a lot.
I know. So police were going on the theory that she drank with the killer, but in retrospect, it was probably a result of decomposition. Based on the crime scene, police surmised that this is what happened to the girls. Somehow, probably willingly, the girls went walking in the dunes. They were only two dunes away from the shore when Marianne was attacked. She was attacked first. Seeing this, Christine took off running uphill. And I learned something interesting. I did not know this, but people feel safer going uphill rather than downhill. So in emergency situations, people tend to run up a hill.
Really?
I didn't know that.
I didn't either.
But think about it for a second. This idea you have some sort of advantage because you're up. Yeah.
I wonder why.
I don't know.
High ground?
High ground. Take the high ground, I guess. So Christine takes off running up the hill. She's screaming. But it did her no good. They were in such a remote area. And the wind was really loud. She made it roughly 112 feet before the killer caught up with her. And he stabbed her repeatedly in the back. He continued the brutal slaughter before dragging her back to where Marianne lay bleeding out. But for some reason, carrying her body, and I get that it's dead weight, but for some reason, he stopped 10 times down that hill.
And I mean, he was strong enough to overpower Marianne, and I understand she wasn't a big girl, but if you've overpowered her and are able to slit her throat, like, why are you stopping so many times?
I have no idea.
Hmm.
And he was able to catch up with Christine.
Right. And you think he would be running just on adrenaline,
that's,
too,
that's
right?
That's what I was saying. Yeah. You can lift cars, allegedly.
Exactly.
With both girls bleeding out between the two dunes, the killer then cut the crotch of Marianne's black swimsuit and he rolled it up to her breast. While she was dying, he raped her. Now, I know the killer cut something of Christine's, but I don't know what. My best guess, and I could be completely wrong, I often am, is that he cut off her sanitary belt, but I don't even know anything about sanitary belts. But I know he cut something off Christine's, and he tried to rape her, but for whatever reason, he couldn't complete the task. So police are examining the whole crime scene. They sifted through almost 600 tons of sand, but they never found any object that they thought could have been used to bludgeon Christine. Because remember, Christine was also beat over the head. They found tire tracks about 100 feet from the murder scene, but no one knows if that's linked to the crime or has no relevance whatsoever. The only item they found that could possibly be linked to the murders was a 1-inch tip of what seemed to be a kitchen knife. It was found 5 meters or 16 feet from the girls' bodies, and there was blood on it. However, in 1965, there was no DNA. And I didn't even find anything that verified it was human blood. The girl's family was obviously just beside themselves. And Mary Ann's brother Hans, along with her mother Elizabeth, they visited the scene of the murders. They were escorted by the police. They really just wanted to see where she died. And this is what Hans had to say about it. This is a quote. "The place the girls were killed was very isolated, even though it was only two dunes back from the beach. It was so quiet, I couldn't even hear the waves crashing. You could scream your head off, and no one would hear a thing. No one would have heard the girls screaming for help." That's how he described it. The story hit Australia like a tidal wave. It plastered the headlines, and the police pleaded with anyone who'd been at Wanda Beach that day to come forward. Now, the Wednesday, 2 days after the murders, detectives finally interviewed the Schmidt children. That's the first time 7-year-old Wolfgang mentioned the teen boy who was crab hunting. He described the young crab hunter as being slender, tall, shirtless, tan, wearing gray shorts, and carrying a homemade spear. He also told authorities about the surfer teen that he'd seen talking to Mary Ann and Christine after he went looking for them. He said the teen was shirtless, wore gray shorts, carried a blue towel over his shoulders, and in another conversation a little while later, he said he overheard the boy asking the girls in an angry tone what their names were, and that he again watched that teen boy emerge from the dunes alone with a towel wrapped around his neck. The issue with Wolfgang's statements, as the weeks turned into a month, his descriptions became more detailed. Somehow his memory began filling in the gaps, and no one's really sure if it's completely trustworthy or not. He eventually concluded that the teen boy he'd seen crab hunting was the same teen boy he'd seen walking in the dunes with the girls. This unknown 16-year-old boy became the prime suspect in the murder. However, when Wolfgang sat down to make an identikit, or a sketch, of the teen, he was so agreeable with the artist's suggestions of how the nose and the hair should look that they couldn't really make what they thought was an accurate sketch. Later, Wolfgang recalled that the surfer teen had a spear attached to a sheath in his waistline as he entered the dune with the two girls. But when he walked out of the dunes alone, he no longer had that spear. And you can see why, I mean, he's seven. You can see why you might start to question, is this something that's finally coming to his brain? Or is this something his brain is filling in? So as I said, this made major headlines all over Australia. And some witnesses started coming forward. There's this one guy, his name was Dennis Dustin. He was a firefighter. He was at the beach, Wanda Beach, that day around the time of the murders. And he described the various people he saw on the beach that day. One was a tall, pale, 19-year-old male. And another was a stocky man in his 40s with leather skin. Police urged these two men to come forward, but they never did. Dennis also saw Christine and Mary Ann walking alone. And he noticed that they kept looking back, almost as if they were checking to see if someone was behind them. But he didn't see anybody behind them or near them. It could be one of those things they're just checking back to make sure the kids are okay. It could be something meaningless. Or it could be that a creepy person was just talking to him. Another witness came forward. His name was Francis Williams. He was 57 years old. He contacted the police 9 days after the murder, and he described what he remembered from being at Wanda Beach that day. He, too, witnessed Christine and Mary Ann. He said they were briskly walking towards Wanda Beach, holding their younger children's hands. So this is before they left the children alone. And he estimated it was 12:45 p.m. He later saw Mary Ann and Christine wander off, leaving the children alone at the dune. Around the same time, he saw a man wearing blue shorts dig a hole in the sand and lay in it. Then the man got up and he kind of brushed the sand off. But why this man stood out in Francis's mind was because the man laid in the hole while wearing a iron corrugated mask. I know, this is like full force Leonardo DiCaprio, the man in an iron mask shit.
What?
Right?
Nobody else mentioned this.
No.
That's fucking weird.
Iron.
In the sun?
Well, it wasn't sunny.
Oh, yeah, it was overcast.
And remember, it was windy. And so if you think about it, I'm just saying, on a squally day, a corrugated iron mask might come in handy at the beach.
Well, sure, the sand's not getting in his eyes.
That's what I'm saying.
That's weird.
He recalled two young boys playing in the sand alone on the beach, and there were two men fishing nearby. Around the same time, there was a woman, and she'd gotten her car stuck in the dunes. So Francis and another man, whom he later saw leaving a truck, helped the bogged woman get her car out. All of this is happening while two young teens are being murdered only a few hundred yards / meters away. As I told you earlier, and the corrugated iron mask man confirmed, there's some weirdos that roamed the Green Hills sand dunes by Wanda Beach. Two teen girls told police that on the day of the murders, they were riding horses. They were approximately 400 yards, 365 meters from the murder, when they encountered a naked man in the sand hills, carrying his clothes. They shouted out on, "What are you doing?" And he ignored them. Police were really interested in talking to two men who'd been spotted on the beach that day. One was described, although I know it's not politically correct, he was described as the fat man. Nowadays, that's a trigger word. It's inappropriate. So we're going to call him a slender man with lots of additional weight on his body. Oh, I'm just fucking around. He was between the ages of 25 to 35 years old. He carried an orange and white towel, he wore gray shorts, and he walked around holding pornographic magazines in his
hands. Are you fucking kidding me?
No, I'm not.
God, people are weird.
I know. Like, Wanda Beach looks pretty, but I don't know, man. There's
a lot of fucking weirdos there. What the hell?
In the days leading up to the murder, this man had approached various women and teen girls at the beach. He said he was from South Australia and was asking them how the sex was in Sydney.
Oh, my God.
And asking them if they wanted to look at his porn magazines with them.
It's a group activity. Come on over. We'll sit in the sand and check these nudies out.
I don't think this guy was ever spotted on the beach after the murders. Anyway, this guy, he never came forward for obvious reasons.
Would you?
But you know what? There are crazy people. I'm surprised he didn't sell his story to some sort of news station. I'm the pervert on the beach. Another shady sort hanging around the sand dunes was a man described to be between the ages of 18 and 20 with a slight build, light brown hair, who was missing teeth. He was wearing shorts and he had on a long-sleeved button-up shirt at the time. And he was propositioning females asking if they wanted a little bit of money for some sex.
Ew.
The fact that he's young and he's missing teeth tells me one of two things. A, he's on drugs, or B, he didn't have no money. Because teeth are important when you're 20.
That's true.
None of the six people that police were really interested in ever came forward to talk. I can't say I totally blame them. I mean, the odds are they were doing something either taboo or illegal at the time. Again, homosexuality was illegal, and inserting yourself into a murder investigation might not be the smartest move if you're a perv looking at nude sunbathers or trying to solicit sex or look at porn magazines with strangers. Doesn't that just tell you how many creeps there are?
Yes.
And keep in mind, this is when the beach barely has any people on it. Because the weather. A psychological profile of the killer was developed, and he was deemed to be a local who frequented the area and knew the dunes well. He was described as a loner who may well be part of the perverted community that frequented the area spying on sunbathers.
What?
Just, I guess, it's a community. I don't even know.
There was a group of people?
There was enough pervs that they
called him a community.
Call it a community. The crime itself was impulsive and may have stemmed from being rejected by the girls or a fantasy that built up and the perpetrator couldn't keep it inside any longer. I'm pretty sure I could have came up with that profile myself.
I was just gonna say.
I mean, months go by and the tips become overwhelming. There were so many tips that 40 investigators worked full time on the case.
Holy shit.
There were thousands. There were so many that it actually ended up hindering the investigation because they didn't know what to look at, what not to look at. And I have no doubt the answer to this is somewhere in those, I think it was like 5,000 tips. Over 7,000 people were interviewed in 1 year by the police.
Damn, they were busy.
But 4.5 months after the murder, on May 29th, a group of kids turned in a homemade crab spear and a pair of flip-flops they'd found by some rocks a few days after the murder. So they actually found it right after the murder, and for whatever reason, maybe they didn't think it was significant, but they didn't turn it in until May 29th. Police urged the owner of these to come forward, but he never did. And the flip-flops and the crab spear were located in the area where the teen crab hunter had been hunting crabs. 6 life-size dummies were made of the 6 men police really wanted to talk to, like the pervs on the beach. They were made into lifelike dummies, and they were put on display at a large event in Australia where a lot of people attended.
That's weird, too.
Oh, you got to see the picture. I mean, it just looks like a bunch of mannequins with some different outfits on, like 2 Speedos and a hat and sunglasses on one.
Is one of them nude?
Wouldn't that be fucking
funny?
Yes,
that'd be hilarious.
Nothing ever came of it. Through the years, 3 people have emerged as persons of interest for these murders. And I'm just going to briefly go through them. And everybody in Australia, you guys know who I'm going to be talking about. First one is Alan Bassett. He's considered a suspect in the murder, not because there's any real evidence tying him to it, but because a detective who had worked on the Wanda Beach murders, his name is Detective Johnson, he became convinced that Alan was a killer. And it was all based on a painting that Alan had given him in 1975. So who's Alan Bassett? I know you want to know.
Absolutely.
I'm only briefly going into this. Alan Bassett, he's a killer. He met 19-year-old Carolyn Orphan at a dance on June 11th, 1966. This is a year and a half after the murders of Marianne and Christine. Carolyn had gone to the Iron Workers Club with some friends when Alan caught her eyes. The two had a great time dancing together. They had a ball. And at the end of the night, Alan offered to take Carolyn home. He seemed like a nice guy, so she accepted. I probably would have done the same before I started a true crime podcast. But instead of taking her back to her Wollongong home, God knows how to pronounce that, not me, he drove her to Mount Ousley. There he attacked her, tying her hands behind her back with her nylons. Then he raped her. He then tied her sanitary belt, which I guess she happened to have on too, tightly around her neck. But that didn't kill her. It just slowly kind of strangled her. Eventually, he tossed her body onto the side of the road, and he found a large rock, and he just smashed her face and her head with it repeatedly. She was found alive the next day on the side of the road, but died as a result of her injuries. It didn't take long for the police to figure out that it was Alan based on the sheer amount of witnesses that saw him leaving the dance with Carolyn. He went to trial. At his trial, he said, quote, "I don't think it's outright murder. I mean, something came over me," end quote.
Shut the fuck up.
I mean, he tied her up.
And you smashed her.
Yeah, and strangled her. But
stop it.
He's trying to act like it's a crime of passion or something. Because he went on to say he didn't mean to kill her.
Okay.
But a judge found otherwise, and he was inevitably found guilty. He served 29 years for the crime, but he was eventually released. So that is Alan Bassett, a suspect. But what does this have to do with the Wanda Beach murders? Well, while he was in prison, he befriended Detective Johnson, who, as I said, had been on the Wanda Beach case. And in 1975, he gave Johnson a painting of a landscape that he titled, quote, "A Bloody Awful Thing." Detective Johnson didn't much care for the painting, and he kind of just stored it away. But a few years later, he was rummaging through things, and he saw the painting, and he looked at it again. And he thought, this looks a lot like the Wanda Beach crime scene. And as he looked at it further, he believed that there were also clues to two other unsolved Australian murders. According to Detective Johnson, only something the killer knew was in that painting. So that leads me to believe that there's more things about the Wanda Beach murder than were ever released. However, Detective Johnson became obsessed with his theory about Alan Bassett, and he pretty much, once he retired, devoted his life to proving Alan did it. He even wrote a book, but he died before the book could be published. However, most of Johnson's colleagues politely disagreed with him. And in 2000, Alan Bassett, he was like, man, I am tired of being a suspect in this Wanda Beach murder thing. And he offered his DNA. He publicly stated, I'll give it up to the police so that'll clear my name. And to this day, it's not known if he ever did give his DNA, but I know that there's no stories that say they tried and he didn't. So that's suspect one. Now let's go to Christopher Wilder. Christopher Wilder, also known as the Beauty Queen Killer, he's originally why I started looking into this story. I got a book on him. And at the time of the murders, Christopher Wilder would have been 19, and he drove a white car. Now, in the tips that were given to police, someone said they thought they saw a white car. But again, there were thousands of tips. However, Christopher Wilder, he had a history of luring teen girls from the beach. He would go to the beach, tell them how pretty they were, ask them to take photos, say he could make them a model. And after moving to the United States, because his dad's a U.S. citizen, in 1982, he came back to Australia, and he abducted two 15-year-old girls, tied them up, and took photos of them. But his parents ended up posting bond, and he went back to the U.S., where he murdered a minimum of 8 women. Christopher's ex-wife, she had called in a tip a couple years after the murder, saying that she thought it was Christopher. But again, there were just so many. And he was in the United States, so by that time, so they didn't even bother to investigate. Christopher Wilder is dead. He either killed himself or died by the police's bullet. Either way, they have a blood sample. And this may come in handy, and I'll tell you why in a minute.
Does he have type A, B, A, B, or O?
Yes. Yes. So we can narrow him into the pool of suspects. So let me tell you about the prime suspect in the Wanda Beach murders. And I'm actually so disgusted / intrigued by this guy that I ordered some books on him. And I'm going to probably do an episode on him alone. The prime suspect in the Wanda Beach murder is known to all Aussie true crime fans. He's called like the Hannibal Lecter of Australia.
What? Tell me more.
His name is Derek Percy, and he is one sick motherfucker.
I think I've heard of him. Maybe. I don't know what he did, but the name sounds familiar.
Well, he's never been convicted of any murders, which is kind of interesting. And as much as I'd love to dive into the twisted mind of this freak, I don't have time in this episode. As I said, Derek was never officially found guilty of murder, and he died in 2013 of cancer. Even though he wasn't found guilty of murder, he was found not guilty by reason of insanity. And this was for the brutal slaying of a 12-year-old girl named Yvonne in 1969, whom he attacked with a knife while she was on a Victorian beach. It's way too complicated to get into this now, but Derek was imprisoned. And in prison, he was able to earn some money, a lot of money. And he was able to run a storage unit, and he was able to have thousands of illustrations and writings he created be put in that storage unit, which was hidden from the police for decades. Eventually, police found this storage unit. And when they did, they found a treasure trove of disgusting, grotesque things. They found journals, and in those journals, they described bizarre sexual fetishes, including coprophilia. Really quick, coprophilia. Can you give me the, can you please look up the technical definition, please?
It is the abnormal interest and pleasure in feces and defecation.
Lovely. He's also into urophilia.
Oh, Lord.
Can you please?
Do I need to look that one up too? It is a paraphilia in which sexual excitement is associated with the sight or thought of urine or urination.
Nice. He also was into torture and cannibalism of children.
Fuck.
Based on the info in the storage unit and the fact that poor Yvonne, she had her genitalia mutilated, police were convinced that he was responsible for at least three other child murders because of the genitalia mutilation. And these are famous murders in Australia of small children, one being three. He could be guilty of up to eight, and some even try to stretch it and say he's responsible for the Beaumont children. But here's why people think that he could be responsible for the Wanda Beach murders, besides
being a sick fuck?
Yeah. I don't know what's in that storage unit. I'm really hoping these two books I bought say it. I know it's wrong. But there's something in it that just really leads police to believe that. Let me tell you why Derek could possibly be the killer. At the time, he was 16. Now, he didn't fit the surfer dude profile. But some people say that he resembled one of the six sketches / mannequins that they made. And there were multiple teen boys seen on the beach. Although he didn't live near Wanda Beach, and he didn't even live in Sydney, his father was very big into yachts. And the family would often travel to yacht regattas.
Oh.
I know. I don't even know what that is, but it sounds like something.
It's a race.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like something I want to be a part of.
Hell yeah, on a yacht?
Hell yeah.
I'm all about it.
So Derek's father would set up family vacations at the same time as these yachting regattas. And oftentimes they were held near, not necessarily Wanda Beach, but in that general area. And during the time of the murders, there was a yachting regatta going on. I think it was about an hour away, maybe less. And what's interesting is that Derek's grandma lived in Ryde, and the girls lived in West Ryde. And in order to get to the beach, remember I told you,
there was only one way,
the train. And the girls were seen talking to a teen boy on the train.
That's right.
So they believe that Derek was at that area at that time, and they know it is very possible he could have met the girls on the train. Now, there's no evidence whatsoever linking him to it, but it is possible. And like, again, I don't know what's in that storage unit. So in 2012, cold case investigators announced that they had found a weak male DNA profile on the shorts of Christine. It was a drop of the killer's blood on her white shorts, which indicated that the killer had cut himself. The profile wasn't strong enough to link it to anybody. And I want to be clear, it's not that they tried to link it to somebody and they couldn't. It's that it's too weak now. But they believe in the next few years, DNA advancements will make it so they can get a complete profile of the killer. And they have Derek Percy's blood, Christopher Wilder's blood, and apparently Alan will give his DNA if he hasn't. So in the next few years, this 56-year-old murder could be solved. As far as the semen sample, that's kind of gone. And there's no mention of what became of that 1-inch knife tip found in the sand. So who knows? And that is the Wanda Beach murder story.
Wow. That's a lot to take in, Talia.
A lot to take in. I really want it solved.
Me too.
Oh, there is one thing I want to say. So I'm not sure if the surfer dude is even really involved, and I wanted to say why. Here's my 2 cents on that. If he's a surfer dude, and he's also the same crab hunter, then why is that homemade spear found where you're hunting crabs? But my point is, why would you go all the way back mm-hmm. when you walk 1.25 miles to the rocks and dispose of it there with your flip-flops?
Right.
Then I thought it could be the fat man because he's out of shape.
Maybe.
Then I thought, I have no fucking idea. And that's where we're ending this. And that's where we're ending this
we
story.
We have no fucking idea. The end. I love it.
And if you like this episode, but you'd like it better with no commercials, or maybe you'd like to get it a little earlier, or you want other episodes not released to the public, you can subscribe to our Apple channel, Crimes and Consequences X, or you can go to patreon.com/TNTCrimes and become a member there. So thank you guys. Thank you, Tanya. It's late. It's time to go.
All right. Until our next episode.
Don't kill each other.
Bye.